I'm sure, as with many of you, about the only experience I have in seeing warfare is watching movies. And, of course, you know how movies are. But there have been some rather graphic depictions in movies. I can remember watching Master and Commander, and that's really not so much an action movie or a war movie as a character study. And it was one of the most gripping movies I had seen in a while. I couldn't watch parts of it because I cared so much about the characters. Not so much that what was being depicted was that graphic, but it gave you some kind of taste for what war must have been like. And you know you're watching a movie, but you know also that that's the kind of thing that did happen to real people in times and places in this world, and even is going on in the world as we speak. I remember seeing one large-scale Civil War reenactment at Gettysburg, and similarly, you had a, perhaps an even more flesh-and-blood example of what warfare might be like. And yet, I have to admit, there is a warfare that takes place every day that I don't cringe that much. I don't close my eyes and say, I can't stand to watch this. And it's the spiritual battle, but you see, that doesn't count. Because when you get to go to Gettysburg and you get to watch armies marching around and the cannon fire and listen to the roar of the cannon and the flash of the powder, wow, that's really exciting. But that's not what really matters. And that's the text that we are studying tonight in Hebrews chapter 12. If you want to be turning there, we're going to continue our study in the book of Hebrews. And, of course, we like sermons the same way. Now, I'm not opposed to a speaker that has some talent and ability. You might think I am opposed to that kind of thing, because I have none. But, you know, if a person can make the message interesting, if he can vary his voice somewhat and keep people's interest and that kind of thing, well, that's so much the better. But if there is no content to the message, then it's all pyrotechnics. It's just all show with no real substance to it. And if I did have to choose between the two, I would hope that I would choose the substance over the pyrotechnics. But if that was true, why would I not do that in my own life? Why do I find in some ways fake representations of battle are more real to me than the real battle that I face spiritually every day? Well, partly that is the weakness of the flesh. That we live in this condition, veiled from the spiritual reality that lies beyond. But that's part of the challenge. How can we open our eyes of faith to see more clearly what is really real and not to be deluded into thinking the things that we can see around us with our physical eyes are what are truly real? And so this is the text where the Hebrew writer says that we have not come to a certain thing that can be touched, but we have come to Mount Zion. And he bases his argument really upon this same basic point. So let's pick up in Hebrews chapter 12, beginning in verse 14. Pursue peace with all men and the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God. See to it that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled. And see to it that there is no sexually immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. For you know that even afterwards, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought for the blessing with tears. Well, that's the first part of this text that we have before us. And this I would characterize as being the statement by the Hebrew writer of what our responsibility is. It's something of a continuation of the argument that he has been making, of course. We're somewhat picking up in the middle of our text. We have spoken previously at the end of chapter 10 of their need for endurance, that when they have done the will of God, they may receive what was promised. And this is really what most of us need as God's people today. We know what God wants. That's not our problem. There are a few difficult passages in the Bible, but those do not cause us nearly the difficulty that the hundreds of passages that we understand perfectly well that we just can't seem to bring ourselves to fully commit ourselves to doing and to obeying, to be motivated to do what we know good and well the Lord wants us to do. So knowing the will of God is not really the problem for us as much as it is just doing it and enduring, sticking with it. We all do it at one time or another, but do we endure? Do we persevere? And that's the same need that we have. And so what would motivate the original readers? Well, he gives a catalog of examples of faith, but none of whom is greater than Jesus, the perfect demonstration of true faith. And so look to him. And you see the endurance that he had, and be motivated because of his love for you and the love that you have for him in return, and recognize that even when you're going through times of difficulty, it is like God is your Father who is disciplining you, training you as his son because he loves you. And so he's just concluded that section in the prior verses here by saying, therefore, strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight paths for your feet, so the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. And he's continuing this figure that he started with at the beginning of the chapter. We need to run with endurance the race that is set before us. And so here's the athlete, and he needs to run the race, and he needs to do so with endurance. But if you're lame, or if you've got some difficulty or some weakness, you have to attend to that so that you can be strong enough to run the race. And so if there's any weakness, fix that, address that, so that you will be able to run the race with endurance. And indeed, when we pick up our reading here in verse 14, he is still continuing this idea because he says, pursue peace. Now, he could have expressed this in a lot of different ways, but he intentionally chooses the word to pursue. It expresses a greater intentionality to it, a greater determination and degree of diligence. It is to chase after something. It's the same word that's used in the New Testament for persecuting people. You know, you think of someone like Saul, who is so gung-ho to destroy those that are devoted to Jesus Christ. Well, that's that same gung-ho spirit and attitude that we need to demonstrate in pursuing after peace and holiness. Now, I might make a comment here a little bit about peace, because I suspect most everybody reads the beginning of this verse to mean get along with folks. And the Bible tells us that, of course. As much as is within you, be at peace with all men. The Bible certainly teaches that principle, but that's probably not what he's saying here. Now, why is that? Because when he uses the word peace elsewhere in the letter, he is talking about our relationship with God. Not be getting along with other people, but rather getting along with God. It is a synonym really for salvation. And its connection with holiness then would be all the more obvious why those two things would go together. Also, and this gets a little bit technical, the way he expresses this in classical Greek, it is the way you would say, pursue peace along with everybody else who is also pursuing peace. And in the context, it wouldn't mean everybody, the people in the world, they're not interested in peace, but all Christians, all of you Christians are working toward a mutual common goal, which is peace with God and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. And you'll notice in this very context here that that's the context in which both holiness and peace have been discussed. Notice verse 10, our earthly fathers disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good so that we may share his holiness. And so when he says pursue holiness, he's telling us, He's obviously resuming the argument here. He's making the application of the argument he's just made. Since God disciplines us for holiness, we need then to pursue and dedicate ourselves to holiness. Likewise, in verse 11, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. And there again is this peace that we have with God because we are disciplined by God and have a right relationship with Him. Now, there's not a huge difference because obviously if we are pursuing this right relationship with God, we will have as much as possible a right relationship with other people as well. But it's a matter of focus. His focus is particularly on our relationship with God. And that's what we are pursuing because first and foremost, we need to be right with Him. And one other thing that further strengthens this connection is, in Proverbs chapter 4, verses 26 and 27, the Hebrew writer is heavily borrowing from this text and alluding to it, if not quoting it explicitly in certain portions, but it's one of those passages that varies a little bit in the Greek translation than the Hebrew text that our Old Testament English Bibles are based upon. And this is what the text says: make straight paths and order your ways. Turn not to the right nor to the left. Turn your foot from every evil way. He will make your paths straight and will guide your steps in peace. And so you see the connection with verses 12 and 13. Strengthen the hands that are weak, the knees that are feeble. Make straight paths for your feet. This is borrowing the language from Proverbs chapter 4. And what does this pathway that we're walking on or running on lead us to? It leads us to peace. And again, that peace of which Proverbs speaks is a right relationship with God. And so that seems to be the focus of what he's getting at here. And so our responsibility is peace and holiness. That's our goal. Now, because of that, he also gives us another instruction, and that is we need to watch out. Now, this is the same word that is used to describe the work of overseers, elders in the Lord's church. They are called overseers because they oversee the spiritual welfare of the flock that they are shepherds of. But what we find in this passage is the work of oversight is not solely the work of the overseers. Now, that's not to deny there is a special category of people that are looked to as the overseer in the same way that the Bible talks about the evangelist. And he has a particular job. But that doesn't mean all Christians aren't to be doing evangelism. Well, we are all ministers. We are all servants of God. But there is still a special category that speaks of those who are the servants, those who are the deacons, for example, or the most common use of that word is the one who is a minister of the word, a teacher of the word. And I think it's the same thing we have here. There's still a special category of those who exercise spiritual oversight in a local congregation in a special way. But there's still the recognition that all of us watch out for the spiritual well-being of one another. So it's not a matter of a difference of work, it's just a matter of the difference in the degree to which we're capable of doing that work. And that's clearly the case. I mean, even if the Bible didn't say this, if Hebrews chapter 12, verse 15 were missing from our Bibles, we would still know this is true. That I'm concerned about you, you are concerned about me, we watch out for one another. That's what we do as family. That's one of the responsibilities we have as family. And so what is it we're to watch out for? There are three things in particular that he mentions. And there are three things that he says we want to make sure don't happen. So see to it, first of all, that no one comes short of the grace of God. That's just a short, simple, direct, all-encompassing instruction. Nobody. We need to make sure nobody comes short of the grace of God. Now, ultimately, there's nothing you can do about that. You can't force people not to come short of the grace of God. But as much as is within us, that we're not negligent, we're not just being careless, not looking out for one another, we are doing that and doing everything we can to see to it no one falls short. Secondly, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble. And that if it does, many will become defiled by that. This is an allusion to Deuteronomy chapter 29. In verse 18. And it's in a context in which God is talking about when they enter into the land, they need to be careful to maintain their purity and their faithfulness. And especially if there are the inhabitants of the land, and they will influence them to follow idols, other gods that they have not known. You make sure that no one springs up from among Israel and leads the people astray in following after false gods. Well, I don't expect in any moment any member of this congregation is going to start encouraging us to begin worshiping Marduk or Baal or Dagon or somebody. But there's many forms of idolatry. Anything that takes us away from God is a root of bitterness. It will cause trouble. It will defile people. And so one of the specific things we're watching out for is that there is no cause of falling away from the Lord, that there is no particular thing that is going to lead anyone astray. There are certain teachings and certain practices that people can get caught up in that will take them away from the Lord. Now, that's not the only thing that'll take one astray. I mean, just general neglect and apathy will, over time, erode one's relationship with God. We should make sure that doesn't happen. But there are also these particular causes that can arise that we need to watch out for, and we need to make sure those things don't happen. And then his longest description of all, he says, see to it that there is no sexually immoral or godless or profane person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. For you know that afterwards, even when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought for the blessing with tears. Well, why bring up Esau? You know, and of course, one of the first questions is it appropriate to characterize Esau as a sexually immoral person? Or is the intent merely to call him the profane person and says the profane, like Esau was a profane person, and not to imply that he was also a sexually immoral person? Well, I don't know if we could settle that with finality. You know, the thing that people point to about Esau was he did marry foreigners. He married some Hittite women, for example, and so that may have been the kind of sexual misconduct that Esau is guilty of. I think it's probably more likely that as the Bible uses this term to describe a spiritual unfaithfulness, a kind of spiritual fornication that people are guilty of, that idolatry is a form of such a thing, that may be more the idea that Esau certainly was unfaithful to the Lord, and it was demonstrated in this particular act that he cites. And now you look at this thing. Okay, he came in hungry one day. He thought, I'm going to die. I'm starving to death. And I suppose it was more hunger than just he missed a meal. You know, I didn't have breakfast this morning. He probably really was, you know, really hungry. And he rationalized, well, you know, what good's my birthright going to do me if I die? So I might as well sell it. And of course, Jacob is not free of blame here. He's taking advantage of his poor brother. I mean, I'd like to think my brothers would share some food with me if I was hungry rather than trying to extort something out of me for it. But hey, that is my brother's, I have to admit. All right. So what's so bad about Esau doing this? Well, of course, it represents a complete disregard for God. I mean, Esau was not simply the firstborn child in some ordinary family. The family heirloom was a promise that God made to Abraham, and it was passed down to Isaac, and it was to be passed down, presumably, to the firstborn child. And Esau doesn't care about that. He just has no regard whatsoever. And that describes a profane person. You know, we might think of profanity as someone that's uttering a bunch of expletives all the time, but it really is just a word that means someone who's not spiritual. But no interest in spiritual things, just the mundane, daily, this worldly kind of stuff. And so you think back to Nathan's lesson about the five foolish virgins this morning. You know, what was so bad about what they did? They're just stupid broads who didn't bring enough oil for their lamps. And for that, the man getting married is all in a peak and slams the door on them? Oh, what sense is that? But we have to put ourselves in their shoes and understand that the height of social interaction in the ancient world was a feast, and there was none greater than a wedding feast. And for anyone to show disregard and contempt for that was the highest form of contempt you could have. I mean, you'd rather somebody just walk up and spit in your face. That would be less contemptuous than someone who treated lightly this amazing celebration that people were having, a once-in-a-lifetime event that you've just walked your muddy feet all over because you completely disregard it. And so in the story, you see, it's not like Jesus has to tell this parable. And he said, well, and the bridegroom came, and then the five foolish virgins pull out their guns and start shooting at him. And because of that, he won't let them in. Well, that makes sense to us, you know. Or some other just really hideous sin that they committed. But what is their great sin? Just apathy, neglect, lack of preparation. What's Esau's great sin? Apathy. Could care less about his birthright. And you see how God thinks of such things, because such disregard is ultimately what it is, a disregard of God. It is contempt for God. It is to spit in the face of God. And so you remember the previous warnings that we've had. For example, in chapter 10, you remember he had said, verse 28, anyone who set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses, how much severer punishment do you think he will deserve who has trampled underfoot the Son of God, has regarded as unclean the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified, and has insulted the Spirit of grace? You ever seen anyone do that? Well, not in some stereotypical way, but that's God's description of those people who have no regard for Christ. Having once been followers of Christ, they turn their back on Him. And look at the previous warnings that we have, and you'll notice that what the Hebrew writer is really doing here at the end is re-summarizing those previous warnings that he has made. So back in chapter 2 and verse 1, for this reason we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, so that we do not drift away from it. For if the word spoken through angels proved unalterable, and every transgression and disobedience received a just penalty, how will we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? He said there's a comparison that is being made. We have that which is greater available to us, and if there were such severe consequences for them, how much worse do you think it will be for us? Then in chapter 3, verses 12 through 14, take care, brethren, lest there should be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart in falling away from the living God. But encourage one another daily, as long as it is called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold fast the beginning of our confidence firm until the end. And then in chapter 4, verse 1, therefore let us fear if, while a promise remains of entering His rest, any one of you may seem to come short of it. And so what do we find then as we get to this toward the end of the book here in chapter 12? The Hebrew writer is saying, you need to watch out for one another. Make sure nobody comes short. He's already told us we need to make sure we don't come short. We just read that passage in chapter 4, verse 1. You make sure nobody else comes short as much as is within your power and influence. Make sure there's no root of bitterness that springs up and causes trouble. And in the original passage in Deuteronomy chapter 29, they turn their hearts to fall away from the living God. And that's the same language that's used in chapter 3. Take care, brethren, lest there should be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart in falling away from the living God. And so time and again we see that these warnings are being given to us by the Hebrew writer. And now as he's summarizing toward the end and kind of bringing us to the point of application, all right, what is it that we need to do? We need to pursue a right relationship with God in all peace and holiness, and we need to watch one another as best as we can in that process, that they too are pursuing peace and holiness. And if there's anything that's defiling that, anything that's getting in the way, then we'll help one another as best as we can. And that brings us then to the reason why we do that, and that is the center portion here, verses 18 through 24. And what he basically says, as we've already suggested from some of these earlier warnings that we've had, we have something better. If the message spoken by angels was so disastrously horrible in its consequences, if it was rejected, then how much worse do you think the consequences will be for those who reject a message that didn't come through angels, but from God Himself through the Son of God? And so the same point is being made here. So verses 18 through 21 focuses upon one mountain, and verses 22 through 24 focus on a different mountain. So beginning in verse 18, you have not come to a mountain that can be touched, and to a blazing fire, and to darkness, and gloom, and whirlwind, to the blast of a trumpet, and the sound of words which sound was such that those who heard begged that no further word be spoken to them. For they could not bear the command, if even a beast touches the mountain, it will be stoned. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I am full of fear and trembling. Well, this clearly takes you back to Mount Sinai, and he doesn't name Mount Sinai here. He doesn't even say it's a mountain. Now, the New American Standard puts the word mountain in there to help make the contrast between this place and Mount Zion in verse 22. But you'll notice it's in italics because the word mountain is not in this passage. It's almost an extra way the writer does to make it even more vague. You know, you've not come to something that can be touched, you know. And of course, the preeminent demonstration of this is at Mount Sinai. But it really seems as if the Hebrew writer would suggest all of the things that you can imagine that are in the Bible that have to do with these external pyrotechnics, the shaking of the earth, the flashes of light and the blazing fire and the thunderous sound and the trumpet and the billowing smoke and the gloom and darkness, all of that, which would just overwhelm the senses. And he's going to basically say, that doesn't mean anything. But if we had been there, would we have been terrified like the people of Israel were? Absolutely. I mean, just the rule that no animal can touch the mountain. If any animal happens, some dumb animal just wanders up on the mountain, somehow breaks through that fence they built to keep everything off the mountain, you got to stone that animal. And that impressed upon the people, how much more so, man, you know, I got a little 2-year-old here I can hardly keep under control. What's going to happen if he runs up on the mountain, you know? We can't get anywhere near that. This is like, you know, 50 gajillion volts of electricity. Don't touch. Don't get anywhere near this thing. And even Moses was full of fear. Now, this is what illustrates to us that it's not just one snapshot of what happened at Mount Sinai, because this statement is taken from Deuteronomy chapter 9 and verse 19. And it is Moses recounting of the history of God's dealings with Israel and says that after you had sinned, you know, I had to go deal with God on your behalf and I interceded for you. And God listened to me. But in that, you know, Moses spent, you know, he was there 40 days the first time. And you can just imagine what that would have been like. You know, here's the mountain and it's shaking and all the thunderous noise and all of that. And Moses is right in the thick of it. And he spends that time with God and God is revealing to him the law and the blueprints for the furnishings of the tabernacle and the tabernacle itself and all of these things, only to be interrupted by the sin of the people. And he has to go down and deal with that. And he comes back and spends another 40 days. You can just imagine. You know, is this on Moses, you know, top of his list, things I want to do? Man, I want to go spend with 40 days right there with God, being terrified, you know. Probably not. And he was so terrified, he could not eat or drink anything for 40 days. So he was fasting. Now, he was obviously getting along somehow, but hey, that's how sick he was. That's just how it impacted him physically to be there in the presence of God. Well, that's really something. And I must admit, I have often thought, man, if I could have lived in the days to see the earth shake and the flashes of lightning and the roar and hear the voice of God himself speaking, maybe I'd be a better Christian. Well, I'm just fooling myself because that's not so. It didn't help them any. And it wouldn't help me any either. Because that's not where faith is found. It's not in the pyrotechnics. It's not in these awesome displays of physical power. True faith is found in the heart of an individual. And maybe that's the problem. We just have so little faith. We don't see what's real. We don't see the real mountain. And that's his whole point here. And so he turns his attention from such a mountain, which naturally everybody's going to be impressed by and think, man, that's really something. I would love to have seen that. But you have come to Mount Zion. That is the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You've come to myriads of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn ones who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood which speaks better than the blood of Abel. And you offer that to people. Say, there you go, there's a mountain. And I say, well, it's not that exciting. I don't feel anything. I don't see anything. I don't hear anything. And it's the same problem you have if you had been physically present at the crucifixion of Jesus. What would you have seen? Three crosses. Three probably ordinary looking people hanging on a cross. Nothing particularly striking about that. Unlike all those Renaissance pictures, paintings of Jesus on the cross, no glowing halo, you know, his cross isn't 20 foot higher than everybody else's. The only thing that tells you anything remarkable is happening in that middle cross is faith. That you're told that this is the center point of all of human history and destiny. Perhaps you might notice that this man behaves himself a little differently than other people do. It is extraordinary in the way that he faces his death. He says bizarre things like, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. But even that ultimately is only explained as we know who Jesus is and what he is doing. And that's why no movie like Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ could ever truly capture what the crucifixion of Jesus is like. It might be helpful historical background information to appreciate a little what is involved physically in crucifixion. But it can never convey to you the reality of God the Creator taking on human form and sacrificing himself for us. And when that happened, the very foundations of hell were shaken. You know, people did not see it with their physical eyes, but you can bet Satan saw it. And all of the forces of evil saw their doom that day. And it's just like if you're, you know, a big fan of Lord of the Rings, you know, when the ring is cast into the fiery pit from which it came, and all of the power of Sauron is just vaporized in an instant. That is what happened to Satan. That is what happened to all the forces of evil. Because something of cosmic dimension, something in the spiritual realm happened that was a greater shaking than ever happened at Mount Sinai. It was a more deafening roar than it was ever heard at Mount Sinai. It was a more blinding light than anything ever seen at Mount Sinai. And the challenge for us is to see that with our own eyes of faith and to believe that something extraordinary happened in Jesus Christ there upon the cross. And because this is the fact of the matter, because this is where we are. That's what the Hebrew writer is saying. It's because of this. He's not arguing this. He's not trying to convince us that this is what happened. He's saying, you know this is what happened. Therefore, what will you do about it? And this is when he comes to the final part of this, which is the only possible result of people that are convinced of this, is what he says in verses 25 and following. See to it that you do not refuse him who is speaking. Do not reject what God says. That's what it all comes down to. And that's the same warning we've seen all along. If the word spoken by angels carried such consequences when people rejected it, then you better make sure you don't reject this message, because it didn't come from angels. It came from God Himself. And if those who violated the law of Moses are punished so severely, how about the very one who tramples underfoot, the very one who revealed God to us, the Son of God? And that was the problem again with Esau. He rejected what God had to say. He had no regard whatsoever for the things of God. And that's why he says, don't be like Esau. Make sure no one else falls into the trap of being like Esau. Because what did Esau see? He saw a bowl of soup. He saw the here and now. He saw instant gratification. And that's what a lot of us see, because that's all we can see. That's as far into the future as we care to look. And we don't think about eternity. We don't think about the spiritual realities, those things that are real, those things that are enduring. It's like Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 16, we do not lose heart, though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. Why? Because these things you can see are temporary. They're not real. They're not as real as the things that are eternal, the spiritual things that you cannot see with the physical eye. And the Hebrew writer is making the same point. And so don't be like Esau, where you only see the here and now, you only see the physical. Look further down the road, have more foresight than that, and see the spiritual outcome of all of this. And therefore, if you really understood him with whom you have to do, you would not refuse him who is speaking. For if those did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, much less will we escape who turn away from him who warns from heaven. And his voice shook the earth then. Wasn't that amazing? But now he has promised, saying, yet once more, I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. And this is a quotation from Haggai chapter 2. And it's rather fascinating because Haggai, of course, is one of those prophets, along with Zechariah, that encouraged the people to get back to work on the temple. And when they did, and at least made some progress in regard, that they could begin looking at it and saying, you know, this ain't going to be much. Certainly by way of comparison with Solomon's temple, it wasn't much. And he says that. The prophet says, those of you who remember the former temple, does this look like anything? Is it nothing by comparison? But I'm going to shake the heavens and the earth, the sea and the dry land. And I'm going to shake all the nations, and all the wealth of the earth will flow into this temple. All the silver is mine, all the gold is mine. And the latter glory of this temple will be greater than the former. He said, well, when did that happen? How is that to be fulfilled? Well, notice what the Hebrew writer does. He says, this expression, yet once more, denotes the removing of those things which can be shaken, that is, created things, so that those things which cannot be shaken, and I suppose he means by that things that are not created, may remain. And therefore, since we receive a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us show gratitude by which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. Well, like many Old Testament prophecies, you can have a multiple application of that principle. But there's always an ultimate fulfillment of the prophecy. And I think that's what the Hebrew writer is getting at here. When he says, one more time I will shake the heavens and the earth. Now, there have been several times God has shaken the heavens and the earth, so to speak. Times of judgment, times of chastisement, times of discipline, days of the Lord in which he brings punishment to the wicked and delivers the righteous. But there's going to be one final and ultimate shaking that will take place, that will perfectly fulfill this one last shaking that has to happen. The shaking, the real shaking. And what happens in this shaking is the complete removal of all created things, everything that is of this life, everything that is physical, everything that is mundane. And all that will be left are the spiritual realities in Jesus Christ. The kingdom of Jesus Christ. God's rule in Jesus Christ. And so we must make sure we do not reject the one that is speaking. He tells us what the reality is. He tells us what is true. He tells us what is real. And do we believe that or not? And if we believe that we have what is real, what is abiding, what is enduring, and what is eternal in Jesus Christ, truly what is better, then our only possible response to that is gratitude. Let us have gratitude toward God, by which we may offer to God an acceptable service, a sacrifice, with reverence and awe. Now this is the only time in the New Testament that this word is used, which is translated here, awe. It means the absolute deepest, most profound respect one can have for God. And when you think about a practical application of that or test of that, you know, it's not do I trust God? That's a significant enough question. Do I fear God? Do I respect God? Do I have reverence for God? Those things are all important. But he says the deepest, most profound respect for God. And that's what you find missing in the lives of so many who profess to follow Christ, but don't really. And we need to look at our lives seriously and see whether what we do or what we fail to do really qualifies to be referred to as awe. The deepest, most profound respect for God. That's what we're called to. It's the only possible respect. You know, when people stood at a mountain that was shaking and the light flashing and the thunder roaring, they were just scared down to their toes in absolute terror of the display of God's power. We've not come to a mountain like that. God's not interested in terrifying us. But he is interested in inspiring within us this deep respect for him. Because when you see Jesus on a cross, and you know that is God doing something he didn't have to do, bearing the price that you should have paid, but he did it for you, does that not inspire the deepest, most profound gratitude and respect for God? And then he concludes, our God is a consuming fire. Well, maybe he says, after all, we ought to be afraid of God. Well, there's some healthy fear that we should have, certainly. And there are many places where God is spoken of as a consuming fire in which we're reminded of the fire of God's judgment, and we don't want to be on the receiving end of that. But that need not necessarily be what the Hebrew writer has in mind here. If you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 9 again and verse 3, the same context in which Moses spoke of his fear at Mount Sinai on behalf of the Israel and so on, God is spoken of as a consuming fire in this context as one who will go before Israel and drive out the inhabitants of the land, and he will consume his enemies, the enemies of his people, and that, of course, is a great blessing for Israel. And in that sense, the statement that God is a consuming fire is a great comfort. Because God will destroy our enemies. God will destroy whatever that is out there that opposes us. And you think what a comfort this would be to the original readers of this letter who are facing persecution and difficulties. They're going through a kind of shaking process. What's going to be the outcome of all of this? Well, there might be a lot of suffering. Their property might be confiscated again. They might wind up in prison. Some of them might lose their lives. But none of those things really matter. Because the things that are real, the things that are eternal, the things that are abiding, are the spiritual realities that are found in Christ. And no one can touch those. No one can take those away from us. And those that are opposed to God will get what is theirs. And yes, if we're in that category, we should fear because God is a consuming fire. But there's also a comfort to it. If we are right with God, then he is that same consuming fire that is burning away all of these things of the earth. All of those created things. All of those mundane things. Where all that will be left is the spiritual reality that is in Christ. And that eternal glory that we will have with God and with one another forever. And we're kind of back to where we began. What we have here is something of a depiction the Bible is trying to give us. To play a movie in our mind of what the glory of God is really like, using words that can only begin to touch the tip of the iceberg. But try to convey to our minds the glory of God and give us some foretaste of that, some picture that we can latch onto and see Mount Zion and what it means, a blood that speaks better than the blood of Abel, a blood that cried out for vengeance and justice, whereas the blood of Christ speaks forgiveness and mercy. And in that, again, there's a greater power and a greater shaking of the things of this world than we will ever realize. We can never fully appreciate God's glory until it is fully manifest to us in eternity. But it is coming, and we need to be prepared for it. What will it be like when he reveals his glory in that time, whenever it might be? If you will, take your songbook and turn to number 746. We'll even sing about that at this time. And as we think about the glory of God and what we should be to share in his glory, We certainly need to have gratitude. We need to have a deeper and more profound respect for God. All of us need to make changes of one kind or another, but if there's some way we can be of help to you in a special way tonight, to study with you, to pray with you, to help you in being baptized into Christ, we're here to help one another. If we can do that, let us know while we stand and while we sing the song of encouragement.